Hey, how's it going? Before we begin, I want to take a minute to thank everyone who's supported the Discovering Bitcoin podcast by sending, streaming, and boosting precious Satoshis via value for value apps like Fountain and Breeze, or Zaps via Nosta. Hearing tales of discovery and recording episodes of this podcast keeps me sane, and your support motivates me to keep going more than you will ever know. Thank you. Are you new to discovering Bitcoin, the network, the asset, the money? Do you want to get up to speed on self-custody, join the evolution, and know how to hodl your Bitcoin safely, securely, and simply? Discover the Bitcoin Advisor, a dedicated team of proper Bitcoiners, hardcore, ardent maximalists, whose sole purpose is to help you to discover Bitcoin, steer well clear of shitcoins, take self-custody, become sovereign, and ensure that you feel confident every step of the way. Click through to the BitcoinAdvisor.com link located in the show notes and tell them DJ from Discovering Bitcoin sent you. Your first month's free when you do.
Can you explain why Bitcoin is such an attractive financial tool?
Because it is somewhat anonymous, not fully, and because you can move money instantaneously.
So the one thing we can count on is discovery. Bitcoin goes forward in the year 2024.
In the immortal words of the Doors,
12, 11, 10,
the time to hesitate
9,
is through.
Ignition sequence start.
We choose to go to the moon 5, in this decade 4, and do the other 3, thing. Not 2, because they are 1, easy, but because 0, they are hard.
All engine running.
Catan, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, man. I was just talking to you off air. I was having a conversation with my old man about Bitcoin. They're starting to, the woodwork is starting to become active again. And
the pennies are starting to drop.
Something's happening, you know. I've been chatting to him about it for at least 4 or 5 years now, surely. And to his credit, he's certainly not ever dismissed it out of hand. But his financial advisor doesn't approve of it. So, you know.
Yeah, my father is very similar, doesn't approve of it. or never did until the price went absolutely ballistic just now. And now he is on somewhat team Bitcoin, but I think he's more team go my son rather than, you know, Bitcoin.
Well, that's a good team to be on.
But yeah, he was one of these guys that was asking me the pizza question of, if I keep dividing, you know, the number of Bitcoin, isn't there an infinite amount of Bitcoin? And so it's
shout
pretty
out to
embarrassing.
Francis Coppola.
But I think now he's starting to realize, hey, that maybe there's something here, but I don't think he's all that convinced just yet. So we'll see.
How are you going to, you know, tamper inflation if the 100 million Satoshis are infinitely divisible?
Well, yeah, exactly. That's his sort of, you know, questioning. Now he doesn't ask those types of questions anymore. I think he kind of understands fractions. So it's quite embarrassing to actually say that, but, you know, it is a unit bias, I guess, or a type of unit bias that people have. And yeah, I think over time, hopefully those fears will be, will dissipate.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I totally see what happens.
It is actually an interesting sort of thought, because I guess that's where like the whole bits, sats sort of conversation tends to take off from. But this idea that people will get that unit bias. Like, I was listening to a podcast earlier today, and it was a Zoomer, you know, like a younger Gen Z, talking about how a lot of his peers feel like they're getting priced out of Bitcoin now, and that they'll never afford Bitcoin. So like
they'll just go and buy Dogecoin or some other shit, right? And he was trying to explain to them, well, no, you know, like you can buy sats and you can buy a fraction of a Bitcoin and blah, blah, blah. But unless you have someone there kind of holding your hand and being like, well, actually, that's not true. Most people may just sort of see that at face value and be like, oh, well, fuck that. I might as well go and get Shiba Inu or something.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's what these shitcoin casinos offer. It's that attraction of, okay, well, Bitcoin has priced me out. Let's go gamble on some other horse that might give me a 2x, 10x return because let's face it, Bitcoin can't do it, is what they think in their minds. And so, yeah, they think that they've missed the boat or they're too late to the party or, you know, whatever else. And they just go with, yeah, some other shitcoin that just, you know, whatever takes their fancy, and then they get rugged on that. It leaves a bitter sour taste in everyone's mouth, really.
Well, John Carvalho and the Synonym team, I think in their BitKit wallet, they actually just have the B and they're not worrying about, you know, calling it sats or bits or anything. It's just Bitcoin. And
yep.
I kind of like that idea actually, where it's just, this is Bitcoin and this is how much you have. And they don't even bother with the different denominations, the smaller fractions, you know.
Yeah, no, that's
it could help.
You know,
I don't know.
It could help. Yeah, it definitely.
It's a bit niche at the moment.
But it is a bit niche at the moment. So we'll see what happens. Let's see what UI and UX brings. But you know,
I got to ask you, how did you discover Bitcoin?
Okay, so. Back in, I know a fairly prominent Bitcoiner in the space.
I was looking for this tweet earlier this afternoon. I was going to try and bring it up, but yes.
And his name is Stefan Levera.
Never heard
and
of him.
He and I went to school, and we also went to university, and he was always sort of anti-government, anti-central banking as well. And he would always tell me, hey, you know, look, central banking's a scam, but he was never able to provide me with an alternative. So I just dismissed him as some sort of lunatic, a Fruit Loop, whatever else. And then one day he sends me the link to the white paper and he goes, hey, maybe you should have a read of this. And then that reading went down the rabbit hole of, okay, let's go into the Reddit forums. What are they saying there about this? And for 2 weeks, I just could not eat. I could not sleep. I was just absorbing as much as I possibly could, trying to wade fact from fiction, because that was, you know, 2013. And he's giving me this, you know, like, what is this? I learned as much as I possibly could. The prominent exchange at that time was Mt. Gox to buy Bitcoin. And so, yeah, I kind of just went in there and kept reading and reading and reading. And I don't think a day since 2013 has gone by where I haven't said the word Bitcoin. It has just had a profound impact on, like, literally, like, the way I view the world. I've had to reconsider my worldviews on what a government is. I've had to reconsider my views on what money is, what makes a good money. I've had to go to these fundamental questions of, look, I've been spending, you know, decades earning Australian dollars, and it really is all for nothing because someone else can just print it away. And I was like, is this? Yeah, I just couldn't believe it. It was just, I couldn't believe how much I had been swindled. And so I just went down this huge rabbit hole, couldn't eat for 2 weeks, and just kept going and going and going. And it was bizarre. the amount of humble pie I had to swallow to just come to these conclusions. And then I had to start sort of telling people, I wanted to tell people about it. But, you know, then people thought that I was the conspiracy theorist and I was the lunatic and I was the Fruit Loop. And I was just, you know, I was called all sorts of names for just saying, hey, look, you know, I think there's something here. Now I don't do that as much. But I was screaming it off the top of my lungs to people. And it just fell on deaf ears, which was kind of frustrating at the time. But yeah, just trying to wade fact from fiction in 2013, Andreas Antonopoulos was probably one of my heroes in the space.
Mm-hmm.
He basically, at the time, he was basically encouraging people to hold, you know, these drawdowns and massive dips that occurred. You know, he you know, hardened my resolve to keep to see this thing through. And so, you know, a lot of my holding is attributable to Andreas, because I probably would have sold hadn't I heard from his voice.
Yeah, wow.
So yeah, that's kind of how I fell into it. That's how I discovered it. Stefan sort of primed me into it, and then sends me the Bitcoin white paper, and then I go onto Reddit, and then I find as much information as I possibly can. And then he sends me to Bitcoin Twitter. And so, yeah, it just keeps going from there. And it's like, I've read, you know, lots of books, lots of, you know, internet forums, views. It's just, man, it's been wild.
It's like insatiable knowledge accumulation. You can't get enough of it.
Yeah, I was obsessed. I was absolutely obsessed.
Yeah,
for at least those 2 weeks. But then, you know, the years following, still obsessed, but obviously not as much as this first initial 2 weeks where I was like, oh, you got to be kidding me, man. Like, this is this real? Like, I was absolutely dumbfounded at how much I was wrong on so many things. It's like, you know, I didn't even know whether the sky was blue anymore.
No, it's orange. Everyone knows that. I mean, what's really interesting in some sort of parallel weirdness is that when I was first discovering Bitcoin, I was listening to Stefan Lavera's podcast and sort of trying to figure out, because he's quite technical orientated and I'm certainly not that. So I enjoyed, like, when he had American HODL on, or a couple of, you know, sort of more, say, culturally orientated guests.
Relatable guests.
Yeah, like that was sort of, you know, talking on my frequency, my small left bell curve brain. But the it's kind of cool. Like, you're getting real time, you know, orange pilled by Stefan, and then he's gone on and orange pilled who knows how many people. It's quite remarkable. But it's really interesting what you're saying about that. You know, couldn't eat, couldn't sleep, couldn't do anything but think about Bitcoin and just try and uncover this thing and prove it wrong or come up with counter arguments, do the whole thing. I mean, that's kind of what people are still doing today. And I think they'll continue to do for quite a long time, hence. And it just gets you. If you're a curious individual and you have, a certain disagreeableness in your personality type, perhaps that kind of definitely helps. You just go head first into this thing, right?
Absolutely. I think you need to have some form of inquisitive nature to you, and just kind of be open to the idea that, hey, my entire worldview and how I perceive, you know, my relationship with money is completely wrong.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like, yeah, once you dive in, it gets, yeah, there's a lot of rabbit holes to go down. I've gone down, you know, plenty of them. And so, yeah, it just consumes you. It really, really consumes you. And I was absolutely obsessed. People were laughing at me for talking about it. And they just couldn't see what I saw. And I found that extremely frustrating, but also lonely. But what was my saving grace was the fact that I had Stefan as my best mate, who we were doing this together with. So it's kind of like, yeah, even if you're alone, as long as you've got, like, I guess, one buddy, just one buddy to sort of, you know, lift you up and say, hey, you're not a lunatic. I think that helps tremendously. And so Stefan was my sounding board for, you know, a voice of reason,
mm-hmm.
to which everybody else thought that I was absolutely insane. It was a bizarre time to be, you know, trying to scream this thing off the top of your lungs. But yeah, nobody else got it. And it was just, I'm just glad that Stefan was there as at least someone I know personally to say, yeah, I'm not insane, right? Like these are reasonable views to hold.
What I find most interesting is not only is that continuing to play out nowadays, but the idea that people are very quick to dismiss something out of hand or make a judgment on something and they haven't done any of the requisite work that is needed to even form an opinion about this thing. And people just do that. Like I've probably done it hundreds of things in my life. But with Bitcoin, yeah, it just attracts the curious people that go down the rabbit hole and really want to learn and understand and try and pull it apart such that they can, you know, disprove it effectively. And it the old saying goes, you don't change Bitcoin, it changes you. But there is just this cohort of people that are quite happy to just say, fuck off, Catan, like, you're insane, you know?
Yeah, and live in ignorant bliss.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm not sure if that is a function of their schooling, because in school, they don't teach you how to think, they teach you what to think.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure if that was there, but what surprises me is that I would have thought maybe in the boomer generation, they might be able to think a little bit more critically, but it seems that they're very closed off to the idea as well. And so that surprises me because I can't say for certain, but I would have thought that they were taught, you know, logical, you know, thought, reason, you know, certain, you know, patterns or critical thinking skills. I know that they, like, certainly when I was going through school, I didn't get taught any of that. It was just here the climate is changing, so you must do this kind of thing. They kind of taught you activism rather than actually, you know, how to think about things and how to come to conclusions. I don't know if that's a symptom of a person or whether we're just biologically wired to be sheep or we're, you know, if this is conditioned into us. I don't know what that function is. I don't know what the answer is, but it seems like there's a large cohort of people who just simply do not want to think and want to blame others or look for somebody else to give them answers and ways of doing things. I don't know what that is. Maybe there is something there, like, because in Twitter, there's followers, right? People follow you.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you know, we're programmed to think that way, but I don't know. I'm not really sure why that is the case, but there seems to be a large number of people who simply want the government to look after them, basically, because it's their problem and rather than, you know, taking ownership and accountability of their own lives.
Well, it's scary. It's a very frightening thing to. A lot of people don't want to peek behind the curtain because it is scary, or it's probably too difficult, or whatever. What I find really interesting is with the boomers, you know, that whole era of the '60s, where they basically told they were the counterculture. They were the culture that was going to change things for the better and peace and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, like Bob Dylan's Times They Are Changing, that's the generation that wrote that song. And there's like a couple of lines in there. Come gather around people wherever you roam and admit that the waters around you have grown and accept that it's soon you'll be drenched to the bone if your time is to you is worth saving. Like this generation wrote songs with as much gravitas as that. And yet when it comes to actual, like, real change, effectual change that will shake the core of civilization and allow it to achieve all of the shit that they were carrying on about in the 60s and 70s, that will go beyond just the music and the art and the culture that they sort of fed into the world. It will actually do those things. And they're just like so not tuned to that. And it's weird to me that a generation who gave us all of that amazing stuff is so anti and actually are the ones actively combating that change, like all the twats in politics.
But yeah, I think they're too far deep. Like, it's just they're paid incentives. Not to think. Like, exactly, it's the incentives, right? The incentive structures there are completely broken. They've spent, you know, 40, 50, 60 years of their lives working for this Australian dollar, and it's now being inflated away, and they just don't want to hear anything that, you know, the next generation is putting forward of how we can potentially solve this problem of continual debasement of currency. But even just in our generation, like, I don't know if you know this band, it's called The Living End. Mm-hmm. And they have a song called Prisoner of Society. And literally they're saying, we don't need no one to tell us what to do because we're on our own and there's nothing you can do. Mm-hmm. We don't need no one like you to tell us what to do. Mm-hmm. Those are the exact lyrics, right? And yet, if I was to say that out today in 2024, I'd be like, no, you know, I'd be ostracized.
Totally.
Whereas, you know, in the 80s and 90s, that was our anthem, like that we lived by that. And it's like, well, what happened to us? Where was our larrikin spirit of Australia? It's all but dead, right? Like, it's all just been completely.
Well, it's hollowed out and it's become co-opted and made into a cliche, right? And that's what the mainstream does. It's really, really good at taking an idea that is pure and good. And I mean, like, the whole punk rock thing from like the what was it, the 70s, I guess. By the time you get to The Living End, you know, and that song, like, that's still kind of, you know, that would have been played on Triple J and you'd be like, yeah, that's really, really cool. I mean, one of the songs of theirs, actually, you've just reminded me, is All Torn Down, which is basically about Fiat architecture and how shitty the city looks, because they just take all of these magnificent old buildings and put up these garbage developments that are ugly to look at. And hearing that song through a Bitcoin lens or with Bitcoin earmuffs, whatever that metaphor is, and the other song, the Prisoner of Society song, and any music really, like, well, literally anything, basically. You just put an orange filter over your neurons and anything that fires through that filter is just going to, you know, it's going to be fiat or Bitcoin, sound money, whatever. It's weird.
It is bizarre. But, yeah, I just make these parallels to, you know, pretty much everything that I come across. But today it just seems like I can't relate to anything under the fiat standard anymore. Whereas back in the day, I could, like, if I listen to older music, I appreciate older architecture. I appreciate why things the way they were. And then today I look at this and it's just, as you said, it's completely hollowed out now. Like, even just relationships, it's a swipe of a finger, and you've evaluated an entire person. It's bizarre. I would hate to be dating today as well. Like, it'd be bad.
Yeah, man, it's got to change, huh? Like, I just imagine, like, I don't know, like, if you've got kids or anything, but like, just to imagine your kid being judged by some asshole on a toilet while they're sitting there doing it. Like you said, you just completely make a judgment on a person while you're taking a shit. Like, that's the height of rudeness. That's insane to me that we can do that as humans. That's not humane.
No. But on the flip side, I also think that, so for example, someone like Bukele, he will literally, like, whilst he's on the shitter, on his iPhone, he will absolutely destroy the US government. Like, his tweets are phenomenal and they're all whilst he's shitting on the toilet. So, I don't know. Maybe there's something there.
Trade-offs, right? There are no solutions.
There are no solutions.
Why do you think you were open to discovering Bitcoin? You obviously had Stefan there sort of pushing you, but did mention you had kind of that, not necessarily that sort of anti-government, anti-thing mindset, but obviously there must be something there. And knowing you as little as I do, but I've had a few interactions, I mean, you don't seem like a man that tolerates a lot of bullshit, put it that way.
No, I'm pretty straight shooter. Having said that, though, I think Stefan did a lot of priming for me. So in my formative years, we'd known each other. So he was slowly chipping away like things about guns, things about libertarianism. He was slowly but sure, like peace and, you know, markets and functioning markets and those sorts of things he'd actually, you know, sort of write about, and I'd read them. And then even like, you know, on Facebook when I had an account, he would, you know, put his comments forward and they'd come up on my feed and I'd be like, oh, okay, that's an interesting view. What a lunatic. Or, you know, but they were there, right? But they were at least there for me to just, you know, ponder over for a quick second. But then, you know, I think I was primed by Stefan to actually get it. Like, it's like, okay, well, this guy is, you know, he's a mate of mine. He's not a lunatic. He's not, you know, he's not a fringe.
Mm.
Well, he was at the time, but he's not like a complete, like he's a nice person.
He just has some unconventional ideas.
And that's fine. I have no problems with that. But it's like, dude, where is this going to lead to? I have no idea. And so I didn't really want to associate with him. But as soon as he sends me something practical to say, hey, look, I've got a solution for you, man. Like, I've got something here that actually solves this. And he's been talking about Keynesian versus Austrian economics. And here is an example of it in action today that you can use right now. And then I'm like, okay, well, you know, he's got me checkmated there.
Yeah.
And so that's probably what got me over the line. I think it was the priming for the few years and then providing me with an absolute, like an actual solution to a problem. Because everyone can sit there and whine, like even the right-wing influencers, like you'll see people on YouTube just bitching and just saying, okay, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. Yeah, that's great. It's wrong. What's your proposed solution?
Right.
And so what I respected about Stefan is that, yes, he was bitching and yes, he was saying it was wrong and this is why, but then he never could back that up with an actual practical way for me to, you know, utilize something or do something that would actually benefit. Like, I wasn't much of a protester. I don't think protests work. To some fringe levels, yeah, maybe, but I don't think that's going to create massive amounts of change. Whereas I did think that, hey, look, if enough people got on board with this Bitcoin thing, maybe we've got a fighty, like a glimmer of hope here, because I don't have to go and deal with the police officers. I don't have to go and deal with, you know, governments and all this sort of stuff. I can just do it in a, you know, sly roundabout way, which I thought was fantastic. So that's kind of what drew me into it. I was also primed with torrents, right? So I grew up in the whole, you know, like Napster, then that got shut down, then we went to Kazaa, and then that got shut down, and then LimeWire, and then that kind of got, you know, shut down. And then we finally came to a solution with torrents, and torrents cannot be shut down. So just on that sort of, you know, wavelength, I was like, okay, well, we're torrenting money here. Holy shit, I don't know if the government is going to be able to shut this thing down like they did with Napster or Kazaa or LimeWire or whatever else, because it's peer-to-peer and it's a network and it's decentralized. And so the fact that I was a bit of a pirate back in the day also primed me into, getting why Bitcoin could survive any sort of attack from governments.
So you would torrent a car?
Absolutely. And I would not see that as theft. No.
That's a really, really niche joke. I don't know. It was a shitty one. Yeah, the start of those movies, you wouldn't steal a car. Man, if I could BitTorrent a Z71 Silverado, I'd fucking oath I would.
I would too.
Yeah. That whole, Pirate Bay, I mean, that stuck out for me back in the day, was this thing just could not be killed. They'd shut down a URL link and then it'd be like, if you knew where to look, it'd be like, there's another one over there. Or there'd just be mirrors everywhere. And it just, you can't shut it down. Even today. And it's not as, I guess, popular because they've kind of figured it out. Like, oh, people actually just want the convenience of having this thing effectively on demand, we should probably stream it to them for a reasonable price. Although they're getting a little bit retarded with their price, which is, you know, encouraging more and more piracy. But this idea that you can access the media that you want in the format that you want, in the time that you want, whenever, and no one can say anything about it or do anything about it. Like, yeah, that's magic.
It is. It is. And I think a lot of, like, now we're moving towards this, you know, subscription model. Like, for example, Tesla is coming around with saying, okay, well, you know, if you want heated seats, you're going to have to pay $10 a month for them. They'll be in your car, which you, well, then that begs the question, do you own the car? And so I think we're moving towards that world where, you know, private property and ownership rights is being challenged and, you know, ultimately you will own nothing and you will be happy is their slogan. And so, yeah, you know, like it's bizarre the way that they're, you know, moving towards away from private ownership to, you know, subscription style models where you own nothing and you just rent it out. I mean, there's positives and negatives to that, but I think overall, if we don't have ownerships of our own, you know, motor vehicles and homes and big ticket items, then, money. You know, what, yeah, and money, of course, then what are we left with? You know, we can be taken advantage of big time through that. And I think COVID kind of showed how much you could be taken advantage of through these incentives, pervert incentives.
Mm, totally. I mean, I don't mind like the idea of Spotify or Apple Music where you can stream on demand, you know, a new album or an old album or whatever it is. It's convenient, right? You're driving around, you're walking around, you're doing whatever, and you're like, oh, wouldn't mind listening to that now. But there is something way better than having that actual physical record, even a CD. I mean, I threw out my CDs a long time ago. I've still got a couple of sentimental ones. But the vinyl, though, got a lot of vinyl. I mean, it's a pain in the ass to play, and it's annoying when the side runs out and you have to flip it over and all that sort of stuff. So from that perspective, like, yeah, I don't mind renting music, but I'm certainly not renting a fucking car with heated seats. That's not happening.
Exactly. So, like, where does the you know, rental sort of stop then? Like, it just keeps pushing forward and pushing forward, and next thing you know, you're in your pod and you're eating the bugs. So it's kind of, yeah, like it's a progressive move towards a destruction of property rights, and I don't agree with it. We need to push back.
And so Bitcoin allows you to sort of pass through that filter. And one of the things that I think is really important, you mentioned this before, was making those ideas practical. Those logical, sane ideas of private property rights, all these things that the Austro-libertarians, the anarcho-capitalists, they go on and on about, the voluntarists versus the coercivists, all this stuff. And you can read all of this stuff prior to Bitcoin, and you can wail against the wall and shout as loud as you possibly can, but literally anyone can come in over the top and go, so what? Like, what are you going to do about it? And yeah, this Bitcoin thing, because it doesn't work with gold. It doesn't work with anything else. Like, this is the only thing, and that's not hyperbole. It is the only thing that actually enables this shit to be fulfilled.
Yes, it is. Yep, you can take it to the grave with you if you want to. You have complete and total ownership of it. And like, even if you think of your property, right, like your house, like if I wanted to build a 50-foot skyscraper on my house, even though I can afford it, will the council allow me to put a 50-foot, you know, skyscraper in the middle of a residential area? The likelihood is going to be a no. So then, theoretically, do I really own my house? The answer is no, I don't. Even though I've bought it, even though I've got the title for it, even though it's mine, in, you know, inverted commas, but really, no, you don't. Whereas with Bitcoin, there are, you know, you have complete and total control over it if you hold your own keys and run your own node. Those are the two things that get you to that financial sovereignty or freedom. And if you do those, both of those things, you become what I like to call a first-class Bitcoin citizen. And so, yeah, that is, you know, when you have total, complete ownership of your money. And you can take that anywhere in the world and you'll be able to, you know, liquidate it or do whatever you want with it, transact on it. You know, it's very, very liberating, is what I would say.
How has discovering Bitcoin changed you?
Lots of ways. I now think of attack vectors a lot more. I feel like I'm a little bit more paranoid than just, you know, happy-go-lucky. I would assess things from a lot more angles. I would try and find, you know, ways of, you know, how I'm going to get screwed over in certain things. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I have matured having known Bitcoin in my thinking. Right. Rather than leaving things up to chance, I feel like, yeah, now I can sort of take control of my own destiny almost. Like, it gives me hope to say, yes, I do think that there is going to be a better world out there for me and my children and grandchildren. And so, yeah, it's changed my thinking completely, and the way I view the world, the way I view governments, the way I view sovereign individuals, who I want to spend my time with. I've had to reevaluate that. I've had to go down some really, really harsh truths, and yeah, it's confronting. It's confronting. Yeah, so it's changed me a lot.
It does. It has this profound effect on people, and it almost does like a 180 on a lot of people. I mean, most of the time.
Look, I was strongly for taking away guns in Australia. Like, that, I was very, very happy with that decision. I thought that was a great thing that John Howard did. Now I've had to sort of eat that and say, hey, look, I got it wrong. That's embarrassing. But it is what it is, right? Like, back in 1996, he did that, and I thought, yeah, that's a great thing that he did. Now I'm thinking, now that I have ownership of something that I control fully, you know.
Well, can you imagine I'd like something in Melbourne in 2021 when they were firing rubber bullets on people for just peacefully protesting? Can you imagine if they had...
like real ones
wouldn't fucking happen if the population had like I totally agree with you too. You know, a lot of these things, they're all counterintuitive, or maybe they're actually really intuitive, but because of the education system, the programming, whatever it is, they seem counterintuitive because it's not presented in a sort of self-defense private property rights way, you know, this framework from bodily autonomy and up, effectively.
Yep.
You once you grok that, like, it just, yeah, cool, open carry, let's go.
Yeah, exactly. And so I've had to like do 180s on a lot of these types of views. So guns was one of them. You know, having ownership of my money was another one. What exactly is my property is another one. It's like, well, I've spent my entire life trying to buy this and going into debt, and, you know, Jesus, what a waste of time. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just, yeah, what am I doing? I've had to reevaluate my life choices, and it's confronting.
And a lot of people, when they are confronted with that, we were talking about this earlier, like the peep behind the curtain, a lot of people can't actually deal with that. That cognitive dissonance kicks in and it's like, nope, escape to the fantasy land. It's so much easier there. And I almost, for a long time in my life, I've always not necessarily been jealous of those types of people, but there are a lot of occasions where I wish that I was that person at the barbecue going, wow, man, that's interesting. Did you catch the game last night?
If I could be that person,
I don't know if life would be more blissful. I don't know if I'd have less problems. Most of the problems potentially just exist in my brain. You were talking about being paranoid before, all of these things. But, I mean, there is a kind of, you know, ignorance is bliss, right? There's a kind of blissful state that one can inhabit if they just look forward to the football every weekend.
Yep. No, I totally get it. Like, it's just, it feels like ignorance is bliss and something that we can just sort of, you know, brush to the side and keep living our lives because, you know, that's the way we were taught to live. It's a very, very bizarre, like, when you have to reconsider those life choices, it's very hard, and people just freeze. And it's almost like a reboot. Like, you can literally see in their eyes, they've just rebooted, they've reset, they've taken the information in and then just gone, no, I've shut down for a second, restart, and then back to the barbecue and the game. It's like, I don't know. It's bizarre. I've seen it. I've actually, yeah, they've just hit the reboot button and then just as if it, what I've said to them just, yeah, it yeah, they just don't get it.
Doesn't compute. Pass it. Get it through the keeper. Yeah. No.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's garbage in, garbage out. It's just like, nah, jettison that. That's too hard basket. Forget it. Move on.
Yep. That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, it almost it. I mean, I've never been a huge sports ball fan. There are a couple of sports that I don't mind, but even them, the joy is sucked away from me a little bit because you just start reading between the lines of everything, all the advertising all over the pitch and everything like that, and it just drains the pleasure out of the actual spectacle.
You know? Absolutely. Like I used to love cricket, and you know, I'd be following the Australian cricket team, the Indian cricket team and all that sort of stuff. And I'd know the stats and everything. Now I just could not care less. It's just, it's all fake.
And so then I wonder, is it Bitcoin like enabling you to sort of see through the spectacle, right? Or is it the actual sport itself is suffering from a quality perspective? Because I think a lot of, like, I used to love the cricket too. I could tell you all the players' names back in the day and all the rest of it. I mean, the sport was a lot bigger back then within the culture, I think. Everything's so disparate and splintered with the internet, which in my opinion is a great thing. But it doesn't have the cultural impact that it once did. You know, there isn't a Michael Jordan. There isn't a Shane Warne. There isn't a Sachin Tendulkar. These sorts of people don't quite exist anymore. And I don't know if it's because there's more to look at, more to read, more to see, or if the actual sport and spectacle itself is actually a bit shit.
Yeah, look, I don't know what it is. I just feel like, you know, like, for example, right, I'll give you one example where, you know, like the Australian cricket team will try to push somewhat of a woke agenda with the climate crisis, and they'll shit on their sponsors, Alinta Energy, for not being clean enough. It's like, it's shooting yourself in your, like, why would you bite the hand that feeds you? That doesn't make sense. And then they just want to keep, you know, pushing these agendas, and it's like, just stop, just play cricket, dude. Like, you are there to bowl people out. You are there to hit big runs. I don't need your views on, you know, whatever the next topic is
or the current thing
of the day. Yeah, the current thing. I just need you to play good cricket, and I need you to do the best you can so that, you know, people enjoy it and people will watch it. And I think, yeah, that spectacle has somewhat been dampened by some of this agenda that just keeps pushing through in sport in particular. It's weird. It's weird how that sort of stuff gets funded.
Yeah, I mean, it's those kids that make it into internships at, you know, Cricket Australia or whatever, and they're so ideologically fired up, and you've got, I don't know, like, there's just no will anymore to sort of counteract that. And it's really interesting because, like, surely the sports people, like the sports fans and people that are paying for this, to watch this spectacle, whether it's at home or, you know, actually at the ground or whatever, most of those people don't care really at the end of the day.
No.
And it's weird that it takes up such a huge amount of bandwidth.
Yes, especially on newspapers and those sorts of things. And it's like, oh man, like, just stop. Why can't you report on Julian Assange? Why can't you report on, you know, like, big ticket items, people who are getting persecuted for doing their jobs?
Because it doesn't sell. That's the thing. It doesn't sell.
Of course not. You know. Exactly. It's all clickbait now. So it's like, oh man, it's just, it's the, again, the incentives are completely broken.
Totally. We've kind of touched a little bit about this, a little on this question. But I guess, the more important part of this question is sort of a two-parter. What have you learned about the world? But more importantly, what have you learned about yourself since discovering Bitcoin?
Ooh. What I've learned about the world is that there are, I guess what I've learned about the world is it can be a very, very harsh place once you've opened your eyes up to what's going on. Mm-hmm. But there is a suggested solution, and that gives me a lot of hope, a lot of hope. It has been, I think, the world, I think, has been corrupted by fiat money, and that's what I've learned about it. And I think there is something there that is countering that, and I think that that will hopefully lead to a better world. That's what I genuinely believe. About myself is that I see now everything as attack vectors. It's so weird, man. It's so weird how much I see everything as an attack vector. I don't know if that's because Bitcoin, you know, is anti-fragile or whatever else, but I've learned so much from there that I want to sort of imbibe some of those qualities myself. And yeah, that's what I've kind of learned about myself, is that I've somehow taken some of these qualities of Bitcoin and imbibed them in my own life, like decentralization. Like, for example, I would not, like, you know, maybe 10 years ago, I would have one source of income, whereas now I would have multiple sources of income. Why? To decentralize myself. So those types of things I've learned about have helped me practically do better, but I only learned about them because of Bitcoin, after I've discovered them.
Yeah, interesting. That idea of decentralizing, particularly your income, I mean, that was made abundantly clear during the last few years, of course.
Yep.
Can you think of any, are there any other examples that you can sort of, that you're trying, when you talk about attack vectors, do you mean mitigating and defending those particular vectors, or maybe going on the offense?
No, I'm always defending. I don't go on the offense. I'm not like a black hat. I don't think of it like that. I'm more of, you know, hey, look, this looks like an issue. I should take it upon myself to potentially do something before this becomes a very big issue later down the track. So, for example, I know that if I keep eating shit, then later on down the track, I am going to pay for that. So I might, you know, maybe exercise a little bit more and clean up my diet, for example.
Yeah.
There are, you know, certain things where I'll go, okay, well, is this doctor actually prescribing me for my own good? And then I'd probably get a second opinion, whereas before I would never have gotten a second opinion. I'd be like, okay, yeah, he's just prescribed me this. That seems reasonable. You know, let's move on. Mm-hmm. Whereas now I'd be questioning a lot of things, medications, vaccinations, those sorts of things. So I see them as attack vectors. it's very sad. It's exhausting almost. I do the same thing with, you know, just day to day sort of like my energy. For example, Energy Australia came around to say, hey, we're going to install a smart meter. And then I call them up saying, first of all, is this a real SMS? Is this some sort of scam? And then they confirmed that, hey, it's not a scam. We're coming out to change you over to a smart meter. And then I said, well, would you, is this, you know, do I have to upgrade or can I decline? Because the attack vector is that they'll turn my energy off from a remote access point of view. Whereas right now they can't do that. I know that there's no programmability to do that. Mm. Whereas with a smart meter, there could be, and I'm not saying that there is, but there could be where they say, okay, we're going to upgrade all the firmware on all of these smart meters, and it's now going to allow remote access sometime into the future. So I think about this, whereas if I was a Bitcoin, like if I wasn't a Bitcoiner, I'd be like, you know what, whatever, they're doing their thing, let them do it, whatever, it's fine. Whereas now I'm looking at how companies behave, how people behave, and saying, okay, is this in my best interest, or are you trying to swindle me here? So I don't like it. I don't like the fact that I do something. Same thing with schooling, like where I decide to send my kids to school. Should I homeschool them, or should I, you know, put them in a Catholic school, or should I put them in a public school? Like I'm re-questioning everything, like anything. Yeah. Like should I even send? Like should I even encourage them to go to university?
Oh,
like it's just it's there's a whole raft of things where I think, hey, these look like attack vectors, and I better do something about it before you know shit hits the fan.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you surround yourself with people that are just not Bitcoiners, you just become that irritating person. It's like, come on, man, can't you just go along with it? Like, why does everything have to be a problem?
Yeah. I feel like that sometimes as well. It's like, yeah, these people, look, they just don't get the way you think. And as a result, they just think you're painful to deal with. And it's like, no, hold on. Like, for example, at my job, they wanted me to download a piece of software, like Microsoft Authenticator. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to download it. So you either provide me with a phone or you provide me with a YubiKey and you pay for it. And so I'm the only one in the office that has some fucking YubiKey to log into the, you know, into the thing.
That's awesome. So it's just...
You know, like I'm just always kind of just pushing back and saying, hey, look, if you want access to my phone, you either give me my own phone that you pay for or you give me some other alternative because you're not getting access to my phone. I'm sorry. Like, I'm not installing your rubbish.
That's so based. I love that. So, it's true, though, man, because like people, like for some reason, people have got it in their heads nowadays that, oh, well, you're working from home. We're not going to supply you any equipment at all. Just go ahead and download Microsoft Teams and we'll all catch up together on like, it's like, no, that's not happening.
Yeah, no, that's not there. Exactly. It's not right. So, you know, and then I think they wanted to do like in my previous building, they wanted to put like, so that instead of issuing passes to get into the building, they said, oh, you can NFC in with your phone. I said, nah, mate, you're going to issue with a freaking pass. Give me a pass so you don't have the ability to track me and where I go and where
I am. So convenient though, Catan. Like, just come on, man. Like,
I know. Yeah, right. So I push back on these things and I'm like, no, mate, like just there's a boundary and you don't dare cross it. And, you know, like you can't ask me to do this unless you supply the equipment.
Well, I can only imagine you must be really good at your job because...
Yeah, they would have fired people by now, but, you know.
Like, there's a lot of value like, you seem to be providing these people to for them to go a little bit above and beyond. Everyone else like, yeah, I'll just download it on my phone and NFC in, no worries. Wow.
Yeah. Well, so these are the type of attack vectors that I think about and that have changed me as a result. But people see that as just Catan's being a dickhead again.
Do you have many friendly work colleagues or are they sort of like lunch is a bit lonely?
So I get along with my direct team. There's a few people that I do to get along with, who have probably, you know, they've come along on the ride with me because I was screaming to anyone, literally people at work, people, you know, at my, you know, temple, I would be screaming to anyone that I could get a hold of. Mm-hmm. And so some have listened, some have genuinely listened and seen the astronomical journey over the years. And it's a year's journey. It's not like this happened, you know, overnight. People hated me from day one. And then, you know, by day 6045, they're like, oh, fuck, maybe he had a point there. And then by day, you know, 9000 or something, they'll be like, yeah, full on Bitcoin, right? So it's kind of, the relationship changes. People start to see, you know, what is right and what is wrong through your lens over time. And so, I have picked up a very, very small percentage of people along the journey and they've kind of been, you know, I'd still talk to them even after I quit my job. So
awesome. That's cool. That's good to know. Okay, I got a question. Were you a pilot or were you flying before or after you were a Bitcoiner?
Good question, actually. So I found out about Bitcoin in March of 2013, went down that 2-week rabbit hole. So if you want to start from there, then yeah, sure, I was a Bitcoiner. And then April 2013 is when I first started pilot training. And so was I a fully fledged hardcore Bitcoin maximalist at, you know, in March 2013? Probably not. Was I there to just sort of, you know, go along for the ride and take a bit of a punt? Yeah, sure. That was more me. But then, you know, I was, I guess, to distract. I needed something else because I used to work for an accounting firm. Well, I worked at an accounting firm at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I just needed something else. So I thought, you know what, I'll do pilot training for a month and see how I go. I got to a stage where I could fly by myself, do a circuit around Bankstown Airport within the month. So I was like, I was pretty happy with that. So then I just decided to continue pursuing it. And I eventually got my private pilot license. And yeah, so then that's basically it. I don't think there was any sort of Bitcoin overlap at the time. It was just, you know, I think it's pretty cool to be able to, you know, fly planes. So I went and did it.
Can you see any overlap now? How does Bitcoin bleed into that? Do you see piloting?
Yeah, so again from... Yeah. Attack vectors, right? So, okay. So every time I get up in the plane, I'm like, okay, what's going to kill me here? So where can I land? Where can I, you know, if there was an engine fire, what would I do? The emergency procedures are very, very Bitcoin alike because you're always thinking about, okay, how is someone going to, you know, take my life here? Similarly with your Bitcoin, how is someone going to take my private keys? So, yeah, I think, you know, with aviation, like I draw some levels of parallel. So like if you're in a single sig environment, like single signature wallets, I compare those to a single propeller. Whereas if you have multi engines, so if you've got two props, that's a multi sig. So I kind of see it in that thing. So I bring, you know, some sort of analogy to that.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's more just, yeah, get my head out of the zone and do something, you know, a little bit different, use my headspace in a different way. But yeah, I'm still like the attack vectors don't go away. Like, it's like, how am I getting screwed? How am I going to die here? Like, what exactly is happening? So, yeah.
But it's a way to quiet the mind in a different way. I mean, you're still quite active.
Oh, it's absolutely liberating. It's liberating. So I see Bitcoin as liberation, and I also see flying wherever the hell I want. Whenever I want to be one of the most liberating things that you can do. Like I can take off, I can land safely and be in Queensland within, you know, 5 hours. I think that's pretty amazing.
That's really
cool. It's pretty awesome. And so you'd be thinking of attack vectors all the whole way of obviously like what's the weather going to do? Where's the nearest airport? Do I have enough fuel? Does that place have fuel? You know, those sorts of things are always crossing your mind and you're always, you know, a bit on edge. But generally speaking, while you're up there, there's no one telling you what to do. You do your own and you just look outside the window and you're like, wow, this is phenomenal.
The pre-flight checks. I always watch the pilots sometimes at the local airport, go down there just for a little bit and watch them, you know, take off, land again. And I'm always fascinated with the pre-flight checks. And I know it's not totally analogous, but they always check over the plane before getting up in it, as opposed to a motor vehicle where we just jump in and off we go.
Yep. No, there's a specific reason for that is because with a plane, you can't just pull over on the side and you'd be like, okay, well, I've got a flat tire now. So, you know, that's fine. We could just pull over on the side of the road. With planes, you're constantly moving. There is no pause. There is no pullover to the side. And so you always sort of have to be 10, 15 steps ahead of where your aircraft is going to be. And so if you've got a flat tire midair, it's not going to end well for you, generally speaking. I mean, you can get lucky, but you don't want to put these things up to chance. You have to inspect the aircraft very, very rigorously. And there's, you know, that they teach you how to look for those attack vectors. Again, I keep saying attack vectors, but yeah, like it's totally Basically preventative measures to make sure that you have a safe flight. Anything can happen up there.
There is a metaphor with respect to securing your private keys in there somewhere. I'll let the listener decide where that lies.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you, you tweeted out the other day, and this will date the pod a little bit, and I hate doing that, but whatever. You got a UTXO that's been mixed 328 times, going for its 329th. I thought that was pretty gnarly. You're still hanging out for that one sat per V-byte, right?
Absolutely. Now, with particularly that UTXO, remember, I don't pay for anything that comes out. So I don't pay for the mining fees. I don't pay for anything there. It just remixes forever for free. So it doesn't wither away. It's in Whirlpool, and it constantly, like, the initiator of the mix is the person who pays for that transaction. So, you know, I'm still transacting. It's just I'm not paying for it. Yeah, but I am still hanging around for that, you know, one sat per V-byte. I think it's going to come back. I got an alert saying we're at 10 sats. I think we're purging now 1.3 sats per byte. So, look, we're getting back down to normal levels, and I think we will be able to transact, at one sat per V-byte again. But it's a matter of just when. So right now it's pretty empty, which is good to see, to be honest. It's very, very good to see.
It's refreshing. Yes.
It is refreshing after particularly a year of literally no transactions. But if you have, right now you're purging 2 sats per byte. So, yeah, 1 sat per byte will be in play very, very soon. The minimum fee is now down to 1 sat per byte. So it's looking pretty good. I think we're going to... Maybe we'll get there. I think so. I think we will.
What is the end game? What is the benefit of mixing a UTXO that many times? Does it increase the obfuscation, or is it just fun?
No, it's just that you're there, you know, continuously being in the mix. You're in a whirlpool, hence the name. You're just sort of jumbling up more and more. You're helping other people with their privacy. That's why I continuously just mix, because it adds to the randomness of it all. Mm-hmm. And so it's like privacy is best when you're in a crowd. Okay. So you kind of just want to be within that crowd. You don't want to, you know, stick out like a sore thumb. And so the more you're in with that crowd, you know, the better it is for your own privacy. It's the same concept as sort of VPNs. It's like everybody has that same IP address and no one has this one singled out IP address. And so we're all safe because a lot of us are in it together. And I think that kind of makes sense. And so that's why I continuously mix. It's not like, okay, yeah, I'm doing it for myself. It's also adding to the entropy of it all. So I think that makes it, you know, a little bit more robust.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I have used the Whirlpool feature on on Sparrow and Samurai, actually,
yep,
back in the day. The UX on the mobile wasn't that great. It's a lot more intuitive on Sparrow.
Absolutely. Sparrow, like, I cannot rave about this wallet enough. I think if you're a Bitcoiner, you are doing yourself a disservice if you are not using Sparrow Wallet. I think it is phenomenal the way that Craig has designed this wallet, the layout of it, the ease of use, the functionality. It's great for beginners. It's great for advanced users. I think it is, like, if you're not using Sparrow at this point, I would really be considering your life choices, to be honest.
Sort your life out.
It's a really, really good wallet, and I think everyone should be using it. He's done a fantastic job, and yeah, I just hats off to him. And literally, I've got a Sparrow wallet hat.
Yeah, me too. I got a couple, actually. They don't stand up too well to the Australian heat, or maybe it's because I'm such a sweaty Betty.
Yeah. So I've got a Citadel dispatch hat as well. That's completely faded. I think my Sparrow wallet hat is also facing the same fate as well. It's kind of fading out.
Luckily, we can buy more, and they're getting cheaper all the time, which is great.
Absolutely. They are getting cheaper, aren't they? Every single day they get cheaper and cheaper. It's awesome.
How do you explain Bitcoin?
I want to solve a problem for them. So it's like, well, what's the issue with your current money? Like, for example, if you've got a shop and you've been debanked or you've been deplatformed, all right,
mm-hmm.
we'll come at it from that angle. Are you facing cost of living pressures? All right, we'll come from it from that angle.
Right.
It just depends on what the person is looking to achieve with their Bitcoin. Are they wanting to transact censorship resistant? Are they looking to buy drugs? Are they looking to save? Are they looking to invest? Are they looking for a better money? Are they looking to upgrade their money? What do they want to achieve? What prompted the question in the first place? So I don't go out. So I've stopped going out and screaming off the top of my lungs about Bitcoin.
Good.
I let people come to me, and the vast majority of those conversations, which I enjoy, is not about convincing that person to, buy Bitcoin or get some. It's more about, well, how do you hold your own keys? How do you run your own node? Those are the types of questions that I like to field. I'm not really there to convince you that you need Bitcoin. I don't care whether you want it or you don't. But if you do want it and you want to learn how to secure it and you want to know how to run your own Bitcoin node and be self-sovereign, I'm here all day for you. Book in a session with me on Ministry of Nodes. I'm happy to have that conversation with anyone that is willing to listen. That's what I offer and contribute to the space. I just kind of go from there, really. Like, it's just those are the types of conversations that I really want to have, not, oh, should I buy some? How much should I buy? Like, I really, that's on you, dude.
Yeah, I ain't doing that either. I got to say, actually, Ministry of Nodes, it's been a phenomenal resource for me personally. I've sort of logged on there a number of times and looked at some of the articles and things just to kind of at least familiarize yourself. But I got to also say, you sort of embody that generosity of spirit that a lot of Bitcoiners have, where they will provide insight, knowledge, even just like a little bit of a tip to sort of crack on with the next thing. I don't know how many times I've sort of reached out to you and just said, hey man, can you just clarify some point or whatever it is? And like without a hesitation, it's just fire back like a couple of things to look at, or, you know, oh yeah, don't worry about that, or, you know, whatever it is. It's so underrated, man, what you do.
Yeah, look, I've started this with Stefan back in 2019. He has moved on to Dubai and he wants nothing to do with Australia, which means nothing to do with Ministry of Nodes, which is fair enough. I'm sort of single solo doing Ministry of Nodes. Basically, we offer, you know, consulting sessions that people can just drop into my calendar, talk about whatever they want to when it comes to Bitcoin, and or even ask me about, like, you know, my YouTube resources where I teach you how to run a Bitcoin node or whatever. And I do get a lot of feedback to say, hey, thanks for this, or, you know, really appreciate that. And it's nice. It's me sort of giving back. It's not really like a full-blown business. It's just me trying to, you know, help people to, you know, get them along that path of self-sovereignty with their money. So either holding their own keys or running their Bitcoin node in the most, you know, however they feel most comfortable doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a video tutorial series that just goes through like the whole, you know, rundown of how to set up a server, set up, you know, an operating system, and just go through it. Or you can, you know, just purchase a plug and play if you don't want to go through the hours of content that I've got online. So it's kind of choose your own adventure. People can book in whenever they want. There's no real, like, you pay whatever you think it's worth kind of thing. That's kind of what I do. And I love doing it, and I want to do it, you know, even more as the years go by. So it's just my contribution back to the network, I guess.
I'll put ministryofnodes.com.au in the show notes for any listeners that want to find that website. I mean, the TAM of potential Bitcoiners is likely to increase. So I think you might have a few more clients, customers as the years roll on, which is a good thing. Plus, you've got the Bitcoin node box as well. And I got a buddy of mine who runs one of those and vouches for it. And it's one of those, it's actually just looks like a little Dell computer or something, like, isn't it? It's just a refurbed PC.
That is exactly what it is. It's a very, very small micro form factor PC. It's a refurbished hardware with a new SSD in it, brand new SSD you get. And really, it just sits away in the background inconspicuously next to your router at home. It sits there online 24/7. And when you are, you can pair your Sparrow wallet up to that and self-verify your transactions, as well as broadcast at, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning or whenever you want to. It'll always be up there, hopefully ready for you to sort of, you know, transact whenever you need it. One of the great things that the boomers did was mass produce general purpose computers, and I'm weaponizing them and using them as Bitcoin nodes. I don't think I can do it's one of the things that I want to do. So it's fantastic. It works well. It's cheap. It's reliable. They're really robust. And so I enjoy building them and shipping them out to various customers all over the world. Like, I've had, you know, in the US, I get a lot. Other countries, like, you know, I've had orders from Israel. I've had orders, you know, all over the world to sort of, you know, that, you know, people want this product and they just want a plug and play solution. So yeah, it's relatively cheap. It's probably one of the cheaper plug and play nodes on the market. And it offers just a very, very simple interface, and it's, yeah, I receive good feedback. The other thing is I receive node feedback, which is great as well, because no news is good news, in my opinion. And yeah, I'm very happy with it. I stand by it, and I will bring more to the Bush Bash and to Bitcoin Alive, which are conferences that are coming up. And yeah, I'll continue to keep, you know, delivering on that as best as I can.
Awesome. All right, I want to bring this into land. What does Bitcoin mean to you?
It means liberation. It means sovereignty. It means hope. It means a better world. There's a lot of things that Bitcoin mean to me, and it's very, very important for me, because I think it's changed my world. It's changed my life. It's changed a lot of things for the better. And I'm very, very grateful that something like this exists, because without it, I feel like we would be serfs on a plantation, and no one wants to be one of those. So I'm very, very grateful for what Bitcoin does.
Ketan, another cracking episode in the bag that elucidates that Bitcoiners are not crazy psychopaths that want to watch the world burn, quite the opposite. And I think that narrative shift will change, is changing. And particularly if anyone listens to episodes of Discovering Bitcoin, they'll hear personal stories like yourself, where you tell the tale of discovery of your Genesis story down the rabbit hole. And it's really interesting because there's a lot of universalities in everyone's journey, no matter when you discovered it, whether it was 10 years ago or yesterday, a day ago. Like, people experience a very similar path, I suppose, you know, unique to their own reality and whatever else. But yeah, it's interesting, man. Listen, thank you very much for spending some scarce time, finite energy, telling us the tale of how you discovered Bitcoin. It's been an honor to speak with you on Discovering Bitcoin, man. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.